Extra, Daily Planet Extra.
He's the criminal's worst nightmare. A cop who enjoys the danger.
No guns, no jiu-jitsu, just bring him down.
Do you really want to jump?
Well, then that's fine with me. Come on.
Wait, what do you mean? Wait a minute. What the...
He was ready to retire. Now, he's gonna wish he had.
Gun!
Raj, meet your new partner.
New partner? Too old for this.
If these guys can just stand each other...
What you got in there?
Boy and Smith?
A lot of old-timers carry those.
The bad guys don't stand a chance.
Don't kill anybody.
I'm too old for this.
Are you as good as you say you are?
Nobody can touch me.
Suppose we better register you as a lethal weapon.
You ever met anybody you didn't kill?
Well, I haven't killed you yet.
The man of Scream.
Merry Christmas, everybody, and welcome to episode 30 of Man of Screen Extra. I am your host, Mike Zumo, and welcome to the annual Christmas episode. As you know by now, my rules for a Christmas episode does not require the covered media to be about Superman, but it does have to have a connection to the Man of Steel. And this time around, I will be covering the 1987 buddy cop action feature film, Lethal Weapon, starring Mel Gibson and Danny Glover. The connection to Superman... here are two. First and foremost, this movie is directed by Superman the Movie's Richard Donner, and the role of Captain Murphy is played by Steve Gahan, who appeared in Superman the Movie as Armus. He's also Richard Donner's cousin. So I've got that on tap for you this time around, but before I get to that, I have some feedback to address. It's been only a few days since you guys heard from me last, but I do have feedback already. This is from Dave McElvenny. Dave is writing in on Man of Screen Extra episode 29, in which myself and my cohorts talked about the first three parts of Crisis on Infinite Earth, the CW crossover. And Dave writes, "Greetings, Mike, Bob, Beth, Brian, and Scott. Wow, a 3.5 hour episode. Quite an achievement. It makes sense since you were discussing 3 hours of TV viewing, but I admire the stamina all of you displayed. I really enjoyed the conversation among you all. It's like being a fly on the wall, listening to a discussion among friends who are passionate about something and who enjoy talking about it. I read all the Crisis on Infinite Earths comics, including most, if not all, of the tie-in books, since I was heavily into reading just about everything DC was publishing at the time. I've also watched every episode of the CW shows Arrow, Flash, Legends of Tomorrow, Supergirl, Black Lightning, and Batwoman, and I've enjoyed them all to varying degrees. I knew, as soon as this crossover was announced, that I'd be watching, even though I knew it wouldn't be exactly the same as in the comics. In fact, that was a point in its favor, since I wasn't especially fond of the original Crisis story and its aftermath. I have to say that, so far, I've been pretty impressed with these episodes, both for the things that are similar to the comics and the things that are different. I'm glad I didn't have to see the death of Supergirl this time, because I still regard that as the worst comic reading day of my life. I was also impressed, in the lead-up to Crisis, how the Monitor was portrayed, particularly in Arrow and Flash, as a mysterious figure whose motives were not entirely clear. Would he be a good guy or a bad guy? This was the feeling I'd had about him in reading the comics back then. It wasn't clear to me for the longest time which side he'd be on. I was glad that Jefferson, Black Lightning, Pierce, got to participate in this crossover, and I'm sure that he will be back on some Earth after this is all over. I also think that Ruby Rose's performance as Batwoman has been better in this crossover than it has been so far in her own show, and I hope that bodes well for the future of her own show. I found it interesting that Mike said that Iris West Allen is his least favorite character on The Flash. When I was reading Flash comics as a boy in the early 60s, Iris West, while she and Barry were still dating, was my least favorite characters because she was often very dismissive of Barry. In later years, I often said that if I ever had a female dog, I'd name it either Iris for Iris West or Lucy for Lucy Lane, because they were the definitive bitches in the comics. I must compliment Mike Zumo as an excellent host. There were a few moments when he was trying to make a point and his voice faded into the background as other folks in the podcast talked over him. He didn't interrupt or scold, but let everyone else have their say, and I admire that. I must also say that Mike was a bit of a mischief maker in teasing Bob Fisher about whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow. I know it was good-natured fun, but like Bob, I will often go on a rant whenever anyone praises that story. Thank you to every one of the people in this episode. It was a fun listen, and I hope you can all get together after the conclusion of this crossover to discuss the remaining two episodes and the crisis overall. Live long and prosper, Dave. Well, as always, Dave, thank you for writing in. Quite a bit to unpack in this letter. And it's good to know that Dave is watching all the shows. As you heard in the episode, a bunch of us, to varying degrees, watched all or some of the shows. I believe it was myself and Bob who watched everything, with everyone else kind of lagging behind. You know, it's a four or five shows. It's tough to keep up with all that. But it's an embarrassment of riches, the fact that we're at a point where we can really pick and choose. And yeah, you know, one of the things I knew coming in, this story was going to be a bear to adapt because, you know, there's so much more real estate in a comic than there is in 5 hours of television. Plus, there's things you just can't do on TV that you can do in the comic. But, you know, like Dave, I think they captured the spirit of the story very well. You know, Dave mentioned that he wasn't a fan of the story and the aftermath. You know, I try not to blame Crisis too much for the aftermath because it's not the story's fault that people screwed things up later. And yes, I'm also glad that Jefferson Pierce got to participate. It looked like he was having a lot of fun participating in the crossover with the rest of the crew. And interesting, Dave thinking Ruby Rose's performance as Batwoman has been better in this crossover than it has been so far in her own show. And you're not the only person to have said that. But here's the thing. I wonder, Dave, which episode you're referring to, because in each part was written by writers of the show that episode was. Batwoman was part two. So in parts one and three, she was handled by other shows' writers. Supergirl in part one and The Flash in part three. And I really don't want to believe that the writers of other shows have a better handle on her than the writers on her own show. But that would be contrary to some of my prior complaints about, you know, when characters would cross over. They didn't always seem to match what they did on the other show. Felicity Smoke was a perfect example of that. She seemed a totally different character when they wrote her on The Flash than she was on Arrow, at least to my eyes. And Iris has always been my kind of least favorite character on The Flash. I mentioned this in the episode. I just don't think the writers of the CW have a good handle on non-superhero women, you know? And Iris has always kind of rubbed me the wrong way, especially ever since she kind of declared that we are The Flash once they got married. You know, it just seemed to just overstep a little bit. You know, it's nothing against Candace Patton, the actress. I think she's doing a great job, but I just don't care for the way she's being written. And as for your compliment, I mean, being an excellent host, thank you. Yeah, and you know, somehow I don't think my microphone is as loud as everybody else's. I have to check that out next time I'm on a Skype call. It always seems like my voice is lower than everybody else's. Maybe I'm not staying close enough to the microphone or what, but that's definitely something I'm going to have to look into. Although there was one point in the recording that I was getting annoyed that I kept saying anything and nobody was acknowledging me. It took me a few minutes to realize that I had my mic muted. The reason why everybody was ignoring me was because they couldn't hear me. So that's the first time anybody's going to hear about that, because I don't think I told them that I was muted. I just turned the mic back on and rejoined the conversation. Even going back into the editing, I tried to figure out where exactly I had muted the microphone, but with all those voices, there was just no way to know. For however long I was gone, they clearly didn't miss me. But, you know, it's tough to write herd on a show with four other guests on it. And it was supposed to be five until Patrick had to bow out. So, yeah, there might be at least five others on the call for the second episode. We'll have to see what everybody's availability is. But I am hoping to get as many of the group back as I can, as is available. And as far as teasing Bob about whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow, it was good-natured fun. And I really don't care for that story either. I just brought it up to get under Bob's skin and make him growl a little bit, you know. Like Dave said, good-natured fun. So, thank you, Dave, for writing in. I know I got to this letter pretty quick because of the quick turnaround to the next Man of Screen Extra, but if any of you have anything else you want to add on the Crisis episode, please shoot me an email, manofscreen@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you, and I'll read it on the next Man of Screen Extra, which will probably be the second half of the Crisis crossover. So, for now, I'm going to take a quick break, play a podcast promo. When I come back, we'll talk Lethal Weapon. Hang around, folks.
Hey, everyone. I'm Michael Bailey.
And I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
You might remember us from such show as From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast.
Whatever happened to that show?
Well, it went away, and now it's back.
We're back?
That's right. After taking a year off and having a preview episode on April 1st, all new episodes of From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, will be available for download or subscription on your favorite podcatcher starting on May 30th, 2018.
We have a lot to talk about right away, like the aftermath of the death of Clark Kent,
the end of Season 2 of Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman,
all of the Superman-related annuals under the Year 1 banner,
Superman v. Aliens, Dawn of a Really Good Crossover,
and so much more as we continue through the triangle-numbered books and the related books for the second half of 1995 as we gear up for that line-wide crossover,
Underworld Unleashed,
starring the newly revived Lex Luthor, and the Superman crossover, The Trial of Superman.
And right around the corner, there's a wedding and a major change for both the costume and powers of the Man of Steel.
There's a wedding? Who's getting married? Plus the side titles, miniseries, and one-shots that we've been really excited to tackle.
From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, covering the post-Crisis on Infinite Earths era of Superman. New episodes drop on Thursdays, mostly. Unless they don't, but there's usually a very good excuse. Show notes, images from the comics covered, and back episodes can be found at www.fortressofbaileytude.com.
All right, welcome back, folks. On to the business at hand, my Christmas episode, and I am sure when you guys heard me mention that I was going to discuss one of my favorite Christmas movies, you thought I was going to say Die Hard. Well, one of my rules for these Christmas episodes of the Man of Screen Extra is that there has to be some kind of connection to Superman in the movie. The only Superman connection I can think of off the top of my head in Die Hard is, if you can even call it that, kind of more of a second degree connection than anything else, is Hart Bochner, who plays Ellis in Die Hard. He was also in Supergirl. I don't know of anybody else in Die Hard who did anything Superman related. So, I'm going with the Christmas movie that's usually forgotten, Lethal Weapon. And our big connection to Superman here is, there are two actually. The first is, this movie is directed by Richard Donner, who famously directed Superman the movie and parts of Superman 2. The other connection that I could think of right off the bat is Steve Kahan, who played who plays Captain Murphy in the Lethal Weapon movies. He was Armus in Superman the movie as well. He's Richard Donner's cousin, the cop who was chasing Lex Luthor that did not get run over by the Metropolis Flyer. So let's go into this movie a little bit. Like I said, Lethal Weapon, original release date March 6, 1987, which is right almost around the time where I am in the regular podcast. I am somewhere between the release of Superman 4 and the beginning of the Ruby Spear Superman, so I am a little bit beyond this date, as Superman 4 came out in June of 87, so, but it kind of fits pretty neatly into where I am in the podcast. So, like I said, directed by Richard Donner, produced by Richard Donner and Joel Silver, and written by Shane Black. I believe this was one of Shane Black's first movies that he has written. He might have actually written the script for this while he was in film school. The cast, top billed, is Mel Gibson as Martin Riggs, Danny Glover as Roger Murtaugh, Gary Busey, well, Wikipedia says he played the role of Jack Joshua. I don't actually know where that first name of Jack came from. In the movie, he's only ever referred to as Mr. Joshua. No first name was ever given for him. Mitchell Ryan plays General Peter McAllister, Tom Atkins as Michael Hunziker, Darlene Love as Trish Murtaugh, that's Roger Murtaugh's wife, Jackie Swanson as Amanda Hunziker, Tracy Wolfe as Rhianne Murtaugh, Damon Hines as Nick Murtaugh, Ebony Smith as Carrie Murtaugh. They are the Murtaugh children from oldest to youngest. The aforementioned Steve Kahan as Captain Murphy. Mary Ellen Trainer is Dr. Stephanie Woods. She is the psychiatrist who is wary of Riggs' suicidal tendencies. Ed O. Ross plays Mendez. He's a drug dealer. Lucia Naff plays Dixie. She is a prostitute that we encounter in the beginning of the movie. Jimmy F. Skaggs as drug dealer number one, Jason Ronard as drug dealer number two, and Blackie Dammit as drug dealer number three. These are the three guys in the one of the opening scenes that are selling drugs to an undercover rigs at a Christmas tree farm. Al Leong as Endo. He is one of the general's men, Peter McAllister's men. Jack DeBoe as McCaskey. He's one of the sergeants at the LAPD in the homicide division. Grand Bush as Boyette. And Henry Brown as the plainclothes cop, which I'm guessing Grand Bush is the detective that introduces Riggs to Murtaugh. Now, a little bit about the background to this film. Like I mentioned before, Shane Black was a recent graduate of UCLA Film School. He wrote the screenplay to this in the mid-1985. He said his intention was to do an urban western kind of inspired by Dirty Harry. I'm guessing Riggs was designed to be the Dirty Harry type character. The original draft of this film was very different and much darker than the final film. That's something that happens quite a bit in the first two films in which Black worked. This and Lethal Weapon 2, Black's original drafts were much darker, and Richard Donner and his people lightened it up and added the some of the comedic elements. Now, even though there are comedic elements in this movie, this is not a comedy by any stretch of the imagination. But there are funny moments, and I do laugh at quite a few of them. The relationship between straight-laced Murtaugh and out-of-control Riggs just lends itself to great comedy. So, Black's original script was 140 pages, and the plot and the characters were different, and the action was much bigger. The ending script contained a chase scene with helicopters and a trailer truck full of cocaine exploding all over Hollywood Hills. Apparently, Black hated this, and just from judging from some of the things he wrote here, this probably would have been cost prohibitive to shoot. So, Black rewrote it into new drafts that were eventually used for filming. So, eventually, after being shopped around a little bit, the script landed at Warner Brothers, where executive Mark Canton took a liking to it. And he brought producer Joel Silver aboard. And they eventually purchased the script for about $250,000. And it was offered to Richard Donner. Fun note, Leonard Nimoy was one of the choices considered to direct it, but he didn't feel comfortable doing action films and was working on Three Men and a Baby at the time. I think the right choices were made by all. One of Donner's biggest contributions is he brought in writer Jeffrey Boehm to do some uncredited rewrites on Black's script after he found parts of it to be too dark. I mentioned that before. He basically added some humor. And eventually, like I mentioned before, Black did a script for the second movie that Boehm pretty much rewrote. And Boehm also went on to write the third film, which I wasn't a big fan of, and an unused draft for the fourth film. So Donner was interested in working with Mel Gibson, who was 30 years old at the time this movie was released. Apparently Donner was interested in working with him after seeing Gibson in Lady Hawk, and casting director Marion Doherty suggested Danny Glover to team up with Gibson. So they brought the two in, and basically they hit it off so well that they decided that within 2 hours that it was going to be Riggs and Murtaugh. Fun note, at some point, Bruce Willis was considered to be Riggs. But again, I think he did well enough to... I think the right decision was made, and Willis found his groove about a year or so later as John McClane in Die Hard. So again, I think everything worked out for everybody. This is considered to be an action movie, but I'm not necessarily sure I really see this strictly as an action movie. To me, and I'm going to talk more about this later, when I look at this film and the others, I'm always more interested in what's going on with the characters. I'm interested in the Riggs and Murtaugh relationship. And these films have huge supporting casts. Murtaugh's entire family, and as you kind of go from one film to the next, they add a character, adding Joe Pesci as Leo Getz in the second film, Rene Russo as Lorna Cole in the third, and then adding Chris Rock in the fourth as Sergeant Lee Butters. So again, this movie is, you know, about character, and the main plots are just kind of, oh, what's happening to these guys as they develop? It's what drives the character development. And I'm going to talk more about that later, but for now, I'm going to take a quick break, play a podcast promo, and then I'm going to come back with the synopsis and go through some of my notes on Lethal Weapon. Hang around, folks.
The time is out of joint.
The time is out of joint.
The time is out of joint.
The year is 1994, or
1944, or maybe 2994, time is under threat, and history is falling apart. Who will survive this crisis, and how will history be changed for those that do? Zero Hour Strikes takes you back to that DC Comics crossover and covers the entire story, issue by issue, tie-in by tie-in, as the DC Universe goes down to zero. Join Bass and Siskoid at fireandwaterpodcast.com or on iTunes, Zero Hour Strikes, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Remember Legion.
All right, welcome back, folks. So right now I'm going to start with the a Wikipedia synopsis for Lethal Weapon. Shortly after his 50th birthday, LAPD Homicide Sergeant Roger Murtaugh is partnered with Sergeant Martin Riggs, a transfer from narcotics. Riggs, a former Special Forces soldier whose wife was killed in a car accident 3 years prior, has turned suicidal and has been taking his aggression out on suspects, leading his superiors to request his transfer. And Murtaugh and Riggs quickly find themselves facing off with each other.
There are those that say you're a good cop.
I try.
I heard about the little stunt yesterday. Pretty heroic. I pulled your file. Said you worked in the Phoenix Project in Vietnam. Is that right?
Uh-huh.
Assassination stuff. It's over, you know.
What is?
The war.
Yes, I know.
Just thought I'd remind you. That's some serious shit you carry.
Be my guest.
Nine millimeter Beretta. Takes 15 in the mag, one up the pipe, wide ejection port, no feed jams.
What you got in there?
4-inch Smith.
Six shooter, huh? A lot of old timers carry those.
File also said you're heavy into martial arts, Tai Chi and all that killer stuff.
I suppose we have to register you as a lethal weapon.
Hey, look, friend, let's just cut the shit. Now, we both know why I was transferred. Everybody thinks I'm suicidal, in which case I'm fucked and nobody wants to work with me. Or they think I'm faking to draw a psycho pension, in which case I'm fucked and nobody wants to work with me. Basically, I'm fucked.
Guess what?
What?
I don't want to work with you.
Hey, don't.
Ain't got no choice. Looks like we both are fucked.
Terrific.
God hates me, that's what it is.
Hate him back, it works for me.
Murtaugh is contacted by Michael Hunsicker, a Vietnam War buddy and banker, but before they can meet, Murtaugh learns that Hunsicker's daughter, Amanda, apparently committed suicide by jumping from her apartment balcony. Autopsy reports show Amanda to have been poisoned with drain cleaner, making the case a possible homicide. Hunsicker tells Murtaugh that he was concerned about his daughter's involvement in drugs, prostitution, and pornography, and was trying to get Murtaugh to help her escape that life.
Mike, the autopsy report showed that Amanda was poisoned. Even if she hadn't jumped, she'd still be dead. She was murdered.
I can't take this.
Mike, why did you try to get in touch with me?
Well, I heard that you were... Somebody told me you were working out here, and I thought maybe you could get her out.
Get her out of what?
Get her out of this stuff. She was into, she was making videotapes, pornographic videotapes, and I thought maybe you could just get her out and help her.
Easy, Mike, easy.
You owe me, Roger. Remember? Yeah. I remember. I want you to find whoever's responsible for this. However many of them there are. Please, I know you can do it. Just find them and kill them.
Mike, I'm a police officer.
I don't give a shit. You're a police officer, Roger. I know you're a fucking police officer. Kill them! Just kill them!
Wait. Raj. Come on. You find them and you kill them. You can do that. You owe me.
Yeah. I owe you. Gotta go, man.
Murtaugh and Riggs attempt to question Amanda's pimp, but find a drug lab on the premises, leading to a shootout. Riggs kills the pimp and saves the life of Murtaugh, who starts to tolerate his new partner.
Catalina, nothing exciting, but I catch my allotment. Mm. Not bad. You do catch a little few things out there. That's what I caught my wife out there. But it's nice fishing out there.
Mr. Riggs, would you like that tart?
Thank you, yeah. Call me Martin.
Martin.
Listen, Mr. Riggs, sit down.
Brianne, this is not the first time we've had company.
You can fool me.
My name is Carrie. I'm no fairy. My sister's Sherry. She's in love with this guy named Mike.
Carrie! Nicholas.
Come on, it was sort of good.
Is it a problem? Said...
Yeah, Dad, why don't you try it? You know,
I'm going to find a foundry because my name is Roger, and I need to be a Roger, and a Sink Queen Hodger, and a Hooter Hotter Hana.
You need some help.
I am.
Hey, Sarge. Thanks for taking out the garbage.
But honey, I'm entertaining our guests. So what you think?
This is nice. You know anything about boats?
I don't know how much they cost.
No, I mean, can you sail this thing?
What's wrong with you? It's not a sailboat.
Oh, yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, there's no trick to it. You know, that's the front, that's the back. Water all around. Yeah. Why you gotta make things so complicated?
Thanks. I don't make things complicated. That's just the way things get all by themselves.
Yeah. You mean Amanda Hunsaker's murder, huh?
Did I mention that? I didn't mention that, did I?
You don't have to say a word. I can read your mind. Oh. I don't get it. What's the matter with you?
What?
Why is there a problem?
There's no problem.
You got one dead girl, one dead guy. The dead guy kills the dead girl. We kill the dead guy because he wants us to be dead guys. It's pretty easy to me.
Well, it's pretty easy for you to say.
Look. A sugar daddy's dealing drugs. She says something or did something or saw something she wasn't supposed to. He pitches off the balcony into the suite by and by. That's why he came at us with a shotgun this afternoon.
I'm sorry, it's just a little too easy, you know. It's just too neat. I can't swallow it.
Of course it's neat. What's wrong with neat? I like neat.
By neat, you mean simple. What's the red one?
Oh, Sip! Sip!
You okay?
Watch out! What button you push? What you doing? Where's my man?
Okay, man. Okay. Is this what you're looking for, Captain?
You asshole!
Daddy! Didn't mean to interrupt one of those intellectual conversations.
What is it, Rianne?
Mark asked me to a club tomorrow night.
You're grounded, you know that.
Oh, please, Daddy.
Mark, which one is Mark?
You know, the blonde one.
The one with pits in his face?
Those are dimples.
Those are pits. When he smiles, I can see through his hair. The answer is no, end of story. Yeah?
Well, come on, Raj, have a heart.
Hey, good buddy. She smoked pot in the house. She's grounded.
Well, next time I'll just take a beer instead. Why can I have a beer and I can't smoke a joint? It's not coke, you know.
Oh, okay, I'll tell you why. Because now, at this moment, beer is legal. Grass ain't. Right or wrong?
It's wrong.
Right.
Right.
Thank you.
They sit up there drinking six packs and I get grounded.
I'm gonna go home.
I lost track. We resolve anything here tonight?
Yeah, we resolve plenty. We resolve that your wife takes out the garbage. Your daughter smokes grass in the house.
And it's illegal.
You don't know a hell of a lot about boats.
Even though the case seems closed, Riggs is aware that the only witness to Amanda's apparent suicide was Dixie, another prostitute who was working away from her normal streets.
So someone was in bed with Amanda Hansack the night she died.
Right up till now, we assumed it was a man.
Okay, suppose it was Dixie.
Okay, disgusting, but okay. Let's say Dixie put the drain cleaner in her pills.
Say someone paid her to do it.
Sure, she thinks fine. Amanda swallows a couple of downers and she's dead. Then Dixie.
If it was her.
If it was her, she's got plenty of time to spritz the place up. Whatever.
Except Amanda jumps out the window.
Oh, and Dixie pushes her, you know, either way.
Either way, she has to make a quick exit because the body's public. So she hauls ass downstairs.
People are coming out saying, what's happened? What's happened?
Somebody spots her. Shit.
That's right. She actually stops and says,
the point being that now she has to cover her ass.
Right. So she grabs the nearest flat foot she can find and she says, officer, officer, I saw the whole thing.
Right.
Right.
Ah, that's pretty fucking thin.
That's very thin.
What the hell? Thin's my middle name.
Yeah, your wife's cooking. I'm not surprised.
What?
Nothing.
Remarks like that will not get you invited to Christmas dinner.
My luck's changing for the better every day.
They attempt to question Dixie at her home, but the building explodes as they approach it. Riggs finds parts of a mercury switch from bomb debris, indicating a professional has set the bomb. Some children who had been nearby witnessed a man approach the house with a tattoo similar to the one Riggs has, and Murtaugh suspects Hunsaker is not telling the full picture. The pair visit Hunsaker before Amanda's funeral.
You want to tell me about it?
Tell you about what?
Don't bullshit me. Your daughter wasn't killed because of something she was into. She was killed because of something you're into. Stop me if I'm wrong.
Roger, I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Hey, Mike, keep your hands away from your pocket, okay?
Take it easy, man.
Fuck you easy. When you called me the other day, you were going to blow the whistle, right?
Blow the whistle on what?
You were going to spill your guts so they kill your daughter. Tell me if I'm wrong. Hey, talk to me. They killed your daughter. They paid off a hooker to poison your little girl. Talk to me.
For my sake, Roger, I've got another daughter.
She'll be protected.
You can't protect her. You don't know these people.
Acquaint me with them.
All the way back to the war. I ended up working with a group called Air America, CIA front. They secretly ran the entire war out of Laos. I was with a special unit called Shadow Company, Mercs trained killers. When Charlie was bringing in heroin to finance the VC government, Shadow Company went in, we burned the whole thing down. We killed everybody. We also formed a plan.
Keep talking.
A couple of years ago, Shadow Company got together again. The war was over. But we still had our list of sources in Asia.
And?
And we've been bringing it in ever since.
Bringing in what?
Heroin. Two major shipments a year. It's all run by ex-CIA, soldiers, mercs.
You son of a bitch. If you were getting cold feet, why did they kill Amanda? Why not just kill you?
They can't kill me. They need me.
Why?
My company, the bank, it's a perfect front. It makes everything look great on the tax reports.
Tax reports?
This is big business, Roger.
Not anymore. I'm gonna burn it down.
You can't. You It's too big, Rog. These people are trained expert killers.
I want to know about your next shipment. I want to know where it's coming in. How many people you got working for
you. I can't tell you that,
I want to know your sources abroad. I want to know how long you've been into this.
As Murtaugh tries to get Hunziker to reveal everything he knows about Shadow Company, Joshua arrives in a helicopter and kills Hunziker. Then Shadow Company attempts to kill Riggs in a drive-by shooting, but he is saved by a bulletproof vest. Murtaugh and Riggs fake his murder in order to gain the upper hand. Shadow Company later kidnaps Murtaugh's daughter, Rianne, and demand that Murtaugh turn himself over to them for her return. Murtaugh and Riggs plan an ambush for the exchange at El Mirage Lake, with Riggs providing sniper support. But Riggs is caught by McAllister, and the trio are taken to an unknown location. Murtaugh and Riggs are tortured for information, but Riggs manages to overpower the captors, frees Murtaugh and Rianne, and they escape to find themselves in a busy nightclub used as a front for Shadow Company. With their cover blown, McAllister and Joshua attempt to escape separately. Joshua manages to get away, but McAllister's driver is shot by Murtaugh, causing the general's car to veer out of control and get struck by a bus on Hollywood Boulevard. And McAllister is killed when a fire causes hand grenades in the car to detonate. Murtaugh and Riggs race to Murtaugh's home, knowing that Joshua will come after his family for revenge. They arrive in time to prevent him, and Riggs beats Joshua in a violent brawl on the front lawn. As backup officers arrive to take Joshua into custody, he breaks free and steals a gun from one of the patrolmen. But Murtaugh and Riggs pull their guns and shoot Joshua dead. After visiting his wife's grave, Riggs spends Christmas with the Murtaughs, having become close friends with Murtaugh and bonding with the rest of the family. Riggs also gives Murtaugh a symbolic gift, a hollow point bullet, which he had been saving to commit suicide, as he does not need it anymore.
Riggs! Yo! After all we've been through, if you think I'm gonna eat the world's lousiest Christmas turkey by myself, you're crazy.
I'll tell you a little secret.
What?
I'm not crazy.
I know.
Oh, good. Let's eat.
Hey, you know something?
Well, I think your daughter kind of likes me.
If you touch her, I'll kill you.
You'll try. Hey, you mind if I bring a friend?
Why don't you bring a friend?
Hey.
I don't think Burbank the cat's gonna like this.
I'll put five on the mutt.
I'm too old for this.
That's pretty much that. That's the synopsis of that movie. Pretty detailed outline of the story there. And you know what says Christmas most of all about this movie? Basically, just as it starts, once you get past the Warner Brothers logo, it starts off by playing Jingle Bell Rock. I mean, you can't get much more Christmassy than that to start a movie. I mean, aside from maybe Santa Claus coming across the screen or something. But yeah. Even weirder, though, and I wonder if this was, you know, maybe this movie wasn't exactly released when it was supposed to be, but this movie was released on March 6th, 3 months after Christmas. So, I do believe one of Shane Black's quirks as a writer is that a lot of his movies are set around Christmas time. But, you know, Die Hard gets all the love as a Christmas movie, and this one seems to have been forgotten. I guess, you know, these movies aren't as loved as Die Hard is. So, there is that. And like I mentioned, our big Superman connection being Richard Donner, who directed the first film. The movie starts with this woman who looks apparently to be a drug addict is hurling herself off of a terrace and onto a car down on the street. Just as Richard Donner's directorial credit comes up on the screen. And look, who doesn't want to have their credit strewn over a dead drug addict with a tit hanging out? You know, the first main character we see is Murtaugh. He's turning 50, and all of a sudden I'm feeling really old, as I can't believe that I am only 11 years younger than Murtaugh is. I was probably a teenager when I saw these films for the first time. The Lethal Weapon films were actually when I got my DVD player in. I think it was 2000-ish when I got my first DVD player, because I got tired of VHS's eating all my movies. I'm not nearly as tired of a disc getting scratched, but, you know, with digital coming up, we'll have to worry about buffering soon. But I bought, and for the record, I watched the director's cut of this movie to go along with this podcast. So if I describe scenes that you don't know, it's probably because you've watched a theatrical cut. The first three films had director's cuts. The fourth did not. So like I said, I've liked these movies for 20 years. The first three films were within the first DVDs that I bought. When I got my DVD player, I bought a whole bunch of DVDs right off the bat. These three, I want to say my set of Ghostbusters that I still have. Maybe my copy of Terminator 2. And I know around that time I was heavily into The Sixth Sense. I think I bought that movie, watched it once, and then I must have sold it or something. I got somebody to take it off my hands because I really kind of lost interest in it very quickly after the one or two times that I saw it. I don't even know if I ever watched it after I bought it on DVD. Might have watched it once. But it's one of those movies I really liked at one time and then just don't want to go back to. But anyway, back to Lethal Weapon. I can't believe that I am, like I said, I can't believe I'm only 11 years younger than Murtaugh is here. And, you know, I just read a note that Danny Glover was 40 when this film was made. So, yeah, I may only be 11 years younger than Murtaugh is in this movie. But Danny Glover, when he filmed this, was roughly my age then. Ugh. You know, I'm getting to this point where some of the movies that I like from the 80s are, I am getting older than the characters in the movies. It just, I think the last time I watched Ghostbusters, for some reason it dawned on me that all of a sudden, I am older now than Bill Murray was when that film was made. So, there you go. Your cheerful holiday thought right there. And now, so Murtaugh turning 50. And his family brings a cake to him in the bathtub. This is why you lock your door when you're in the bathroom. Well, one, I don't take baths. And secondly, no. Don't bring me a cake while I'm in the tub. And his daughter Rianne will point out that, you know, the beard makes him look old. And gentlemen, you know that the beard tends to gray first. I know mine did. So to contrast the Murtaugh happy family here, here's Riggs. And that's basically a story of a man and his dog in a camper on the beach. He pulls his camper around with his pickup truck. And we get our first glimpse of Mel Gibson here, rocking the 80s mullet and not a whole hell of a lot else to get out of bed. He has a beer for breakfast, which tells you just about where Riggs is. I'm 99% sure that Mel Gibson was around the same place at that time. You know, again, talking about age, according to some of the notes that I read, Mel Gibson was 30 when this film came out. About 9 or so years younger than I am now. So, again, I'm not liking this trend. So, one of the jokes that will reverberate, at least through the first two films, is how bad of a cook Trish is. And I know they lay that on pretty thick in this movie. You get a sense of the Murtaugh's political leaning as there's an end apartheid magnet on Murtaugh's fridge, referring to the segregation practices in South Africa at that time. Pay attention to that. I'm not necessarily sure that's purposely foreshadowing. I'm not sure they were thinking about a second movie at this time, but apartheid is going to be a plot point for a little bit of Lethal Weapon 2 as they deal with South Africans. So, there we get a look at Murtaugh's house, you know, very decorated for Christmas. So, yes, clearly a Christmas movie. There's a lot of bouncing here between Riggs and Murtaugh as we're getting a look at their separate lives, you know. For nerd context, you know, think of the Batman Superman movie animated series. Let's not invoke the thoughts of Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice if we don't have to. Where, you know, the movie starts out with the characters seeing the characters individually before they merge. This is kind of what we're seeing here. We're seeing the happy Murtaugh family as a direct contrast to the miserable, lonely Martin Riggs. And now we know why Riggs is miserable. There's a wedding picture on Riggs' TV. We do not know anything about Riggs' wife at this point. All we know is that she was in a car accident 3 years earlier. Again, the death of his wife is something that's going to come into play largely in the next film. So, but she's not around. That's all we know, and we know that he misses her. He still wears the wedding band, so you can tell that that something tragic probably happened. So, like I said, I watched the director's cut, which adds a scene of the first action shot of Riggs responding to a school shooting with no regard for himself, and it establishes his skill with the gun as he basically shoots the guy who's holding the kid hostage full of holes without really getting a good look at him. They get a little bit of how crazy Riggs is that he'll go into the situation. He'll get the job done, but he'll do it with no regard for his own safety. And then, you know, kind of as a lone gunman, he kind of just walks away. Eventually, we learn the jumper is Amanda Hunsicker, who we find out is the daughter of Michael Hunsicker. Good old police work to provide the necessary exposition. So Roger is personally affected by this case now. And this movie is notorious for this is the first on-screen, at least that's what IMDb says. It's the first one of the first depictions of a cell phone with Murtaugh carrying this box-like thing with a phone attached to it. Very big, very bulky. It's easy to see why this device didn't really catch on. So, what would have been the intro to Riggs in action in this movie actually would have been Riggs busting a coke deal at the Christmas tree farm. And, you know, I love this line as he's screwing around with these guys. And they don't believe he's a cop, and he goes at his line, you know.
Now, that's a real badge. I'm a real cop, and this is a real fucking gun.
But, you know, it shows how it's a little crazy, you know. When he can't come up with the money, he's slapping himself. Probably, you know, one, he's out there. And two, I think he's trying to make the guys uncomfortable. Because once the guns come out, he takes care of business. So, he's good at his job. But at home in the dark, he's thinking about his dead wife and contemplates joining her. But, you know, can't quite bring himself to do it. Either he can't do it himself, or truly deep down, he doesn't want to die. But right now, he doesn't appear to have anything to live for. But later on in the film, he is going to reveal to Roger why he doesn't pull the trigger. And a big part of this movie is bringing Riggs around and to the point where you're taking the suicidal Martin Riggs, and I'm not going to say he's inhabited by the spirit of Christmas, but the exposure to Roger and his family brings Riggs around. I mean, he's still batshit crazy in these movies. At least the first three. They tone him down a lot in the fourth. But, I mean, he's still got his uniqueness, but they bring the character to a much better place than he is here. So, now for your first Christmas alert. We have these cops performing a very shitty version of Silent Night. Yeah, maybe these cops are good at busting the drug deals, but Jesus, do not let these guys sing. That is a crime in and of itself. So, this scene also gives us our first look at Captain Murphy, who, like I said, played by James Caan, a cousin of Richard Donner and Armis from Superman the movie. He is the person who is going to eventually assign Riggs to Murtaugh, and he is probably the only person who has any faith in Riggs, any belief that Riggs is not going to drive everybody off the deep end. He's the only one who believes that maybe Riggs is not suicidal, that Riggs is a good cop and deserves another chance. So he's really the only person giving Riggs a chance, at least at first. Eventually, Roger's going to come around. So Roger learns about his new partner as he sees, Riggs take out a gun. I mean, here's Riggs, who's all disheveled. You know, is he wearing a checkered shirt or some kind of plaid, jeans, boots? He doesn't look like a cop. Everybody here was walking around in shirts and ties, and you got a this guy who looks like he just came in off the farm with his mullet, and he pulls out a gun. You'd think he's probably going to shoot up the place. If you don't know him, you don't necessarily think that Riggs is a cop. But the detective kind of comes up to him. Roger, meet your new partner. And that's where we get the first utterance of probably the line that is most synonymous with this franchise, even though it didn't originate here.
I'm too old for this shit.
Now, these guys are such a contrast. Roger is clean cut, wears nice suits, and Riggs the jeans, boots, and the type of guy, sloppily dressed, probably doesn't bathe very often. Roger is cruising toward retirement, and Riggs is more of an out-of-control wild man. And this movie, and the other three by extension, are made on the chemistry between Glover and Gibson. You know, I said it before, the A-plot has always been secondary in my enjoyment of these films. What makes this film, and even the lesser sequels, work is the character stories. Every character's life grows throughout the course of the four movies, and each film will advance their lives in some way. It's not like the Superman movies of the late 70s and the 80s, where you kind of have to, you do your movie, and you reset the status quo at the end. Everybody gets older, their lives move on, and that just makes them feel real. It makes you feel like these characters have lives that extend beyond the 8 hours we get to spend with them. You know, like I said, not like Superman, where, you know, it feels like you close the toy box and you open it again for the next movie. And I've talked so much about our main leads, not much about our villains. And our villains are scary. Especially Gary Busey as Mr. Joshua. He is an ex-Special Forces guy, and the first thing we see him doing is kind of letting the general burn his arm to show his loyalty, which scares the hell out of this drug-dealing customer. So, this is way before, actually, the batshit crazy Gary Busey that's basically an internet meme now. And Busey's career at this time was kind of at a low ebb. And he credits this film. And, you know, watching this film last night for this podcast, it didn't dawn on me how little Gary Busey's character is in this movie. Like, 75% of this movie is dedicated to the development of Riggs and Murtaugh. I mean, as well, it should be. It's their movie. You know, I mean, I'm going to get to a point where it's going to dawn on me right when Joshua kills Hunsaker. That's about an hour and 12 minutes into the movie. That is Joshua's second scene. After this, we're not going to see Mr. Joshua again until that scene. And you don't miss him because you're so caught up in what's going on with Riggs and Murtaugh. And again, this is a Christmas movie. A lot of Merry Christmas is being thrown around in this film. You know, I really should have, I couldn't find this easily, and I'm not going to go back and rewatch the movie again just to count this, but how many times Merry Christmas was said in this movie. It was said quite a bit. So, yeah. Christmas movie. So, we're going to learn that Roger owes a debt to Amanda Hunsaker's father, Michael, who had called Roger at the beginning of the movie. He wants Roger to kill his daughter's murderers, despite Roger's obligation as the police officer to bring them to justice legally. So, apparently, the debt, when Hunsaker says that Roger owes him, is that Hunsaker took a bayonet in the lungs in Vietnam to save Roger's life. And I love how Riggs deadpans that this line of like, yeah, that was nice of him. As you know, as he just kind of held the door for him going into the department store. So we move on now to a jumper. And Riggs goes up there to talk the guy down. But yeah, smart move on everyone's part. You send the guy who's supposed to be suicidal to talk a guy off a ledge. Well, it doesn't go as planned. Riggs, they end up jumping together onto the big air cushion, and that's how Riggs gets a jumper down. And this just drives Roger stark raving angry, and I love how angry Roger gets. He kind of drags Riggs across the street, and you can see it developing as they're together. And it's when they get past their anger, when that boils over, is how Riggs and Murtaugh develop as characters.
Get in here! Hey, okay, no bullshit. You want to kill yourself?
Oh, for Christ.
Shut up! Yes or no? You want to die? Yes or no?
I got the job done. What the hell do you want?
You didn't answer the question.
Oh, what do you want to hear, man? Do you want to hear that sometimes I think about eating a bullet?
Huh?
Well, I do. I do. I even got a special one for the occasion with a hollow point. Look, make sure it blows the back of my goddamn head out. Do the job right. Every single day I wake up and I think of a reason not to do it every single day. And you know why I don't do it? This is going to make you laugh. You know why I don't do it? The job. Doing the job. Now, that's the reason.
You want to die?
I don't. I'm not afraid of it. I ain't afraid of it.
Here, take my gun. Don't nibble on the barrel. Pull a trigger. Go ahead, pal. Be my guest. Go ahead if you're serious.
You shouldn't tempt me, man.
Put it in your mouth. Bullet might go through your ear and not kill you.
Yeah, under the chin.
Yeah, under the chin.
I'm hungry. I'm going to go and get something to eat.
Eventually, you know, Roger is screaming, do you want to die? And Briggs is screaming back about how he considers eating a bullet. And then through that screaming, you get the reality. And Briggs answers the question that I posed earlier. Does he have anything to live for? By his own mouth. The job is what keeps Riggs going. And I don't think that's the answer Murtaugh was expecting. I mean, Murtaugh reminds me a lot of a guy I used to work with. And I doubt he listens to this. And even if he, and either way, I'm not going to mention his name. But one thing, you know, by profession, I'm a journalist. I'm an editor for a newspaper. And this was at a different newspaper where I was an assistant editor. This guy, he wanted to come in. He wanted to do what he was expecting to do that day. And then he wanted to go home. Yeah, sure. Maybe that's what we all want. But sometimes, you know, in journalism, like in police work, something happens that just throws a monkey wrench into your day. There's the big thing. There's the big crisis that a cop has to deal with. There's the big developing story that a reporter has to cover. And Roger strikes me as the type of person who just wants to do his shift and go home. He doesn't want to do anything dangerous. He just wants to do his investigations and go back home to his family, where Riggs is more, you know, he's after the action a little bit. So after the jumper, you know, I don't want to say, I'm not going to say Murtaugh's a lazy cop, but he definitely has no ambition to risk his neck any more than absolutely necessary. So after the jumper, things are, you know, not as tense as they were in the old construction building that Riggs and Murtaugh were yelling at each other in, but Riggs catches Roger talking to himself, and they start talking, probably for the first time.
50 years old. What a birthday. Goddamn, 50 years old. Been on the force 20 years. Not a scratch on me, not a scar. Got a wife, kids, house, fishing boat. All the kids, all I can buy, because my new partner has a death wish. Fucking life is over.
Just
shut up, yeah? And why are you talking to me anyway? I'm a dead man. Hey, fuck, are you looking at a dead man here?
What?
Don't worry. You know, I was driving before you were itching your daddy's pants.
I didn't know that.
You know what?
I didn't know that it was your birthday today.
No, it was yesterday.
Oh, well, happy birthday for yesterday. I'm sincerely happy birthday, man.
Thanks.
Maybe we'll stay alive long enough for me to buy you a present. I mean, you know, don't thank me now. I mean, it's the least I can do after all the kindness that you've shown me. Hey, are you gonna tell me where we're going? We're together on this, right?
Beverly Hills. We got an address on Amanda Hunsaker's meal ticket. But remember, he's not a suspect yet, so we question him, not damage him, okay?
Oh, sure, yeah. Okay, I won't hurt. Look, I'll let you do all the talking.
Let me do all the talking. Remember that. Let me do all the talking.
Experience counts here.
Yeah. You're not going to smoke in the car, are you?
Well, I am. God. What, does this bother you? I mean, I'll put it out if it bothers you.
Yeah, it bothers me.
Does it?
Yeah.
How about I open a window? Will that make you happy?
No, that's not the point. You know, I had to watch out for my lungs. You know, I exercise, I take care of myself.
And it comes out that the day before was Roger's birthday. And Riggs delivers this line, says, maybe we live long enough for me to buy you a present. They smile and they start laughing. And this is the first time these two men genuinely laugh together. And right in that moment, the relationship between the two men is starting to form. One of Roger's bugaboos about Riggs is how quickly he kills people. So they go after, quote-unquote, Amanda Hunsaker's meal ticket, basically a pimp, and he tries to shoot Roger, and Riggs takes him out. I mean, Murtaugh kind of asks him if there's anyone he didn't kill. So even though they just shared a laugh in the car, they're back to their adversarial relationship. And I think Murtaugh's a little out of line here. I mean, yeah, they lost the lead, but that was a justified shooting. The pimp was going to kill Roger, and technically Murtaugh owes Riggs one here, and eventually he admits it, and he does eventually thank Riggs for saving his life, but I think Riggs could have taken this a little more gracefully here.
You saved my life. Thank you.
I bet that hurt to say.
Never know.
They're not there yet. There's always going to be a tension between Riggs and Murtaugh just because of their personalities. Their dynamic is that Riggs, no matter how close they get, Riggs will fluster the hell out of Roger. And you do see over the four movies, and just talking about this is giving me a hankering to watch the other three, is that you do see over the course of the four movies the respect that is built and the friendship that is built between the two of them. Especially there's a great scene in the third film, which is my least favorite of the four, but there's still great stuff even in that. Roger is talking about retiring and Riggs can't handle it because at that point, everything he has is because of his friendship with Murtaugh. He even, and I quote, he says to Roger, I have three great kids, all of them yours. So that shows that eventually how intertwined the characters of Riggs and Murtaugh are going to become. But they're not there yet. But they do, after all this, they do have their first dinner scene together. As Murtaugh shows Riggs something he's unfamiliar with. The togetherness of the Murtaugh family is a direct counterpoint to Martin's loneliness, and this is what Riggs wants. Murtaugh has the happiness that has eluded Riggs. So the dinner scene and the talk on the boat later is the first sign that Riggs and Murtaugh are starting to bond, and it's the chemistry between them that really makes this film. Beyond that, it's just an ordinary action film. It's really not a whole hell of a lot of action. This is a character movie, and the characters are fully realized. I mean, that other beloved action film, action Christmas film, Die Hard. Not a lot of character with John McClane beyond the everyman just kind of thrown into an extraordinary circumstance and is in over his head and has to solve this problem in the space of a few hours. Much more time passes in this movie, and there's much more character development throughout the course of this movie than any of the Die Hard films. In the Die Hard franchise, all of the character development happens between films, where you get to, this is where John McClane is here. This is where John McClane is in the third movie. John McClane is here for the fourth, you know. You see them go from point A to point B in these movies, where you kind of drop in on McClane where he is at that time. So, Die Hard is plot first. These are kind of character first. And every scene with Gibson and Glover is gold. And I love the scene in the bedroom that's just weird saying that out loud, but apparently Rick shows back up at Murtaugh's the next morning with coffee, and he's like,
hey, morning, Roger. Here, have some coffee. Hey, Roger, I've been doing a little thinking. I've been doing a lot of thinking, actually, about the night Amanda Hunsecker died.
Oh, how'd you get here?
Trish let me in.
What time is it?
It's daytime.
Okay,
Died, she... What was the name of that hooker who witnessed the jump?
Oh, come on, you let me go to sleep.
No, come on, we gotta get up and catch bad guys today.
Okay, I'll go get a shower.
Policeman.
I'll get a shower.
Yeah.
A shower.
What was the name of that hooker? You know, the one that witnessed the jump?
I said I'll get a shower.
Wilshire Vice says Century City is not a usual
Dixie.
Turf.
Dixie, name is Dixie. Give me that cup. And get out of here.
What, Marta asks, what time is it? Rick says daytime. Yeah, I kind of use that line on my daughter sometimes. So after they work out, then something about Dixie. Dixie's house blows up, and this one black kid says that his mom says cops shoot black people, which is a weird thing to say to a bunch of black cops. Riggs is the only white cop there. Unfortunately, that issue has not gone anywhere in the 22 years since this movie has come out. It's still white cops shooting black people, unfortunately, is still a problem. And Roger kind of handles this kid. You know, you tell he's really talking down to this kid. You would think Roger, the family man, would know a little bit better than that. But the kid pretty much describes Mr. Joshua, who has a matching tattoo to Riggs, which is a special forces tattoo. So, Hunsaker was involved with the bad guys. He was trying to get out, and that got his daughter killed. So, there goes Hunsaker, and I love that bullet through the glass. And again, this is Mr. Joshua's second appearance in the movie. 1 hour and 12 minutes in. I'm not sure Riggs thought he was going to shoot down that chopper with a handgun, but he tried. He tried so hard. So, after the Hunsaker death, the action plot kind of goes into motion, and the character development continues somewhat, but at some point the main A story has to be resolved. So they fake Riggs' death after he's shot in a drive-by, and Riggs shows that he's got some brains as tells them, we have an advantage now. They think I'm dead. So now Rianne gets kidnapped. Apparently there was a description of a blonde kid with dimples, and it's kind of unclear, but was Rianne dating Mr. Joshua, who was probably 30. That is never really made clear, but did something happen to the kid that she was dating, or did Joshua do something to him to get to Rianne? It's unclear, but bottom line, Rianne ends up kidnapped, and so now to get his daughter back, Murtaugh is going to have to play the game Riggs' way.
You know they're going to kill her, don't you?
Yes.
And if you want her back, you're going to have to take her away from them.
I know.
Right. We do this my way. You shoot to kill. You get as many as you can. All you gotta do is just not miss.
I won't miss.
We're gonna get bloody on this one, Roger.
Are you really crazy? Or are you as good as you say you are?
You're gonna have to trust me. Here we go.
Murtaugh spent this entire film trying to get Riggs to stop killing people, and now Roger is in a position where he has to shoot to kill to get his daughter back. And for his little girl, he'll do it. So then we go to the desert shootout to meet to get Rianne. So we have a little shoot. This turns out to be a shootout. We get the first of many destroyed Murtaugh station wagons. But everybody is caught. Rianne is recaptured, and they have none of our leads know anything, but they're tortured nonetheless. And there's this great moment where the general says there's no more heroes in the world. Riggs comes in and starts beating everyone's ass. So now they split up. Riggs goes after Joshua, and Roger takes out the general with his handgun, basically shooting out the driver and causing the car to crash. The car goes right into the path of a city bus and explodes on a bunch of grenades. And Roger's intention was to kill General McAllister. He basically says it right before, no way you live. And this is going to be a direct contrast to what happens later with Riggs and Joshua. As here is Murtaugh, who's been preaching, shoot him in the leg the entire movie. And he says, no, I'm shooting him in the head and this guy is going to die. No way you live. And also, after Joshua gets away, throughout the whole film, Murtaugh wouldn't let Riggs drive because he's supposed to be suicidal. Then he realizes that Joshua knows where Murtaugh lives. Yeah, all of a sudden, he lets Riggs drive. So, apparently, they get to Murtaugh home before Joshua does. And he hates Christmas. And as he gets mad, as I believe that Alastair Sims' version of A Christmas Carol, one of which I've never seen. I've been watching different versions of The Christmas Carol every year. I believe this year I'll be checking out the Patrick Stewart one, which I'm from 1999, which I've never seen. So, there's that. The cops are there first, and this scene has now the iconic image of the cop car coming into crashing into Roger's house through the living room window, taking out the Christmas tree. I'm not sure how Riggs got Roger to sign off on that plan, but this distracts Joshua and leads to an impressive fistfight between Riggs and Joshua on the front lawn. Gary Busey is great in this role. He doesn't overplay it, and he is genuinely scary. He's got this sinister smile that just, that's very chilling and very menacing, which is what you want in this particular villain. And now, here we go, while Riggs and Joshua are fighting. All these cops are just surrounding the place, and they're giving it to Riggs and Murtaugh's vanity by allowing this. These guys could easily train their guns on Joshua and arrest him, but nope, they're going to let Riggs and Murtaugh have their pound of flesh. Well, mostly Riggs, he's doing all the fighting. So after this fight, it's easy to think that Riggs would just kill Joshua here, but he decides to arrest him. Killing Joshua is not worth it. Riggs, who is killing everybody, makes the decision here to let the bad guy live. So it's a very interesting reversal as Murtaugh went for the kill and Riggs went to subdue. Which, at the beginning of the movie, it would have been the opposite. Murtaugh would have gone to subdue and Riggs would have went to kill. But they end up both having to kill Joshua when he goes for a patrolman's gun. And it's a great shot of Riggs and Murtaugh both with their guns smoking and right on Joshua. So this time they both had to do it. With all that done, Riggs tells his wife Merry Christmas and he gives Roger the bullet that he showed him earlier, saying he won't need it. And I love how the film ends. Roger comes running out of the house because he doesn't want to eat what he calls the worst Christmas turkey by himself. And they go in together, they bring the dog, and there's some hilarity with Riggs' dog and the Murtaugh's cat. We don't see it, but we hear it. We hear the squeal from the cat and something crash and everybody yelling. And this movie is a great show of two completely different people becoming very good friends. That's what these films are about. That's what I like about them. And, you know, the action plot is there because there needs to be an action plot. but it's the character that drives these films. The rest, pretty much window dressing. Now, next time on Man of Screen Extra, I'm not sure, because probably I don't expect there to be another Man of Screen Extra until the second half of Crisis on Infinite Earths finishes on the CW. So probably that will probably be the next Man of Screen Extra sometime in January. Still not clear when the main podcast is coming back. Definitely sometime in the new year. I'm continuing to build up episodes. My work schedule changed in September and kind of affected how much time I have to dedicate to the podcast. So I want to make sure I have plenty of episodes already queued up before I start releasing, so that way I can keep my weekly schedule. But I will eventually be back to the main show with Ruby Spear, Superman, and Superboy. Until then, feedback is always welcome, manofscreen@gmail.com. If you want to join the conversation over the Facebook group, just put Man of Screen Podcast in your search feed and the show should come up. You can also find the show on Twitter at Man of Screencast. Until next time, folks, remember, if you feel like you're getting too old for this shit, you probably are. Merry Christmas, everybody. Happy New Year. Whatever. Happy Hanukkah, Happy Kwanzaa, whatever holiday you celebrate this year, enjoy it. Be safe, and I will talk to you in 2020. See ya. The Man of Screen Podcast is produced by Mike Zemo, and all opinions expressed on the show are those of Mike Zemo and his guests and no one else. All music and sound clips used on the show are for review purposes only, and no copyright infringement is intended. All music and sound clips are copyright to their original copyright owners. The Man of Screen is a member of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network and can be found at www.twotruefreaks.com. Email to this show can be sent to manofscreen@gmail.com. And you can also leave the show a review on iTunes. That will help others find the show. Thank you for listening to the Man of Screen Podcast.